you don't look that old.
Thank you, but I started back in 1997. Some people are hustlers due to necessity. I had it just in me. One of the many common features between entrepreneurs is lacking the fear of failing. But now, being in Bulgaria, what's the worst that can happen to you? Nothing. Of course, you learn the most from your greatest failures. What we wanted to do with Clever Pine is to set autonomous product teams. And we do not sell people or man hours. We sell the commitment that with a team of this size or whatever size that we construct, we will deliver this in a time frame for a fixed budget. We're focused on the happiness.
How do you measure that? How do you... how fast the Japanese whiskey is going out in your office?
The other way is the commitment from the team members. A lifestyle company does not mean that it's all play and enjoyment.
Mm-hmm.
If you enjoy and you feel satisfied with what you do and you get the gratification of your day-to-day work, and I mean immediate gratification, so you're happy with what you do today, then you come every day to the office and this will not bother you. And because you get immediate gratification, it's like whatever you want, eating an ice cream, being a leader and entrepreneur. It's a matter of iterations.
Well, what is your wildest dream for Clever Pine then?
We aim in 5 years to work with companies that are...
Hello, Recursive Community here from Sofia. In the next episode of our podcast, we have invited a guest who has been a visionary leader in the field of software development for over 15 years. Radoslav Kajtarski is the co-founder of Clever Pine. Born at the height of the pandemic, today the company employs over 100 employees and has quadrupled its revenue, despite the tough market dynamics in the IT sphere. Recently, Clever Pine announced a joint venture with the aviation industry leader Lufthansa Technik. The new entity, which is called VTech, will play a vital role in the digitizing of the processes at Lufthansa Technik. Prior to that, Radu was a co-founder and CEO of Upnetics, a company that became a leader in mobile development in Eastern Europe and was acquired by the largest software company in the country. Radoslav, it's a pleasure to have you here in our podcast.
It's a pleasure to have you here in our office.
This time it is a collaboration. You're giving us the space. We're coming back with the tough questions.
Yeah, I will ask you to be forgiving.
Don't worry about it. It is, I think, a nice occasion why we're here. A recognition like this one from multinational industry leader like Lufthansa is... something that we haven't seen that much in our small country, Bulgaria. But before we get into that story, I wanted to bring you a bit back in time and maybe find out a bit more about who you are.
How far back should we go?
Well, when I was doing my research, I saw that you have initially studied in the States. And I was wondering, when I was reading about your biography, why did you come back? Because at the time when you were there, you know, the IT industry was booming in the States. I can imagine that the career opportunities has been quite attractive for you, but somehow you saw the potential in Bulgaria and you came back here. Why?
That's the story goes before me going to the States. So I was always an IT enthusiast since kid. So I basically started playing games when I was 4 or 5, computer games, back in the very early 90s, 1991. And I have the passion for IT. So after, in my early teens, I started programming like all the geeks.
Which was the first programming language that you've used, by the way?
Of course, at that time was Pascal. You know,
I didn't imagine that you're that old. I'm sorry. You don't look that old.
Thank you, but I started back in 1997.
Okay.
So, yeah. And I graduated in informatics and mathematics high school here in Sofia. And during my studies, I found that I love IT, not for the IT, but because it is a means to solve a real life and business problems.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And coming from a family where my father always traveled around the world, the idea of studying abroad was always part of me and our family. And it was at that point, 2003, it was a rare opportunity to be able to study in the States in an American university. And I knew that I have to take it, but I never envisioned myself staying there, living there, or remaining in the States in the long run. So it was a very, very straightforward line from Sofia to Seattle and back. There were a lot of opportunities in the IT sector, and not only in Seattle. At that point, it was the real Silicon Valley.
Oh, wow. Okay.
It's Microsoft was founded.
True,
there, you know,
true.
Boeing at that point was a huge company in the software industry. And Oracle, of course. And all those companies are born and based in Seattle. But they were interesting for internships, for me personally. But I recognized Bulgaria as the place where I believed at that point of time, and I'm now sure that it was correct in that point of time, that Bulgaria offered more opportunities for people that has a rare talent.
And good education.
And good education, of course, yes.
Yeah, that was also one of the things that I saw when I decided to move back, because of the brain loss that we have experienced over the past years. Somehow, if you are good educated, if you're ambitious, if you want to have an impact, it's much easier to build a career in Bulgaria. Like, I felt that in a more competitive market, you might have the steps in the career ladder like 1, 2, 3, 4. In Bulgaria, it's 1, 10. 3, 10. Exactly. So somehow you take over much more responsibilities and more interesting tasks and more strategic decisions earlier in life, which I believe is actually an amazing opportunity. As an entrepreneur, sometimes overloading, because no one taught me how to be a leader, how to be a CEO of a company, and so on and so forth. I also needed to learn them the hard way. That's also one of the topics that I wanted to dive in with you. Why entrepreneurship? How did you come to the conclusion that that's a viable career path for you? Was it also related to your father? I'm not so sure what was his profession.
No, he traveled the world, but he was an electrical engineer.
Okay.
Head of electrical engineering, but no. He was not an entrepreneur, nor was my mother. I guess the honest answer here is some people have this embedded in them since they're born. I do not see how I could have grew this talent back in time. Since seeing now retrospectively, I'll put the first evidence of me being entrepreneurship in my early teens, going back to the IT geeky world.
What was your first project? What was your first startup?
I had a computer at home, and in early mid-90s I had a dial-up access to the internet. And I started various ventures. Let's record, of course, most obvious ones were downloading content from the internet,
of course,
getting into floppy disks, later burning CDs, of course, and selling it to wherever you can.
Neuro Burning Rome, I remember the program.
Of course. Started with speed 1, 2,
yes,
and finished 1632. But yes, and on the other hand side, having access to the internet broadened my view or even understanding of how money can be made.
Mm-hmm.
When I started understanding HTML and coding, whatever, I created the websites for that that ran ads.
Mm-hmm.
Which, of course, I never managed to collect the cash out because they were paying in checks. And at that point, you cannot cash checks in Bulgaria. But anyhow, so back then I had I also helped people build computers themselves,
mm-hmm.
Which was paid, of course. So very early on, I had the idea and not the need to how to make money because I'm coming from a wealthy family according to Bulgarian standards back in the day.
Someone told me that, you know, if you're going into entrepreneurship for the money, that's actually the wrong reason.
Maybe, yes. But some people are hustlers,
yes,
due to necessity.
Mm-hmm.
I had it just in me. I didn't have the necessity to make five level, one level for this.
Then why would you? Isn't it much easier to have a lazy life? I don't know. Like
I don't know. It's, as I said, it was part of me.
Mm-hmm.
Now looking back, you know, being almost 40, looking back, I can easily identify.
Okay.
That's in my early teens, I was already entrepreneur. Had an entrepreneur mind.
Okay, yeah, an entrepreneurial spirit.
And spirit, yes.
I can see that. I always wondered if it is something that you have in your core, or is it something that you develop? I myself, for instance, I don't believe that I have the entrepreneurial gene in my core. I look at my family. I remember the first time when I decided to launch a venture, a project, and establish a company and become a CEO. My father was very worried that I might get into debt. And he was talking because I was living in Vienna. He was very cautious and he told me, hey, you have to be careful what you're getting in yourself into, because he had a very different idea of what entrepreneurship is all about. So I developed this over the years, and I don't believe that it's something that is, I don't know, set and part of our core.
You continuously develop yourself as a leader and entrepreneur for sure. And one of the many common features between entrepreneurs is lacking the fear of failing. So I've never had this fear. Maybe because I always maybe had the subconscious understanding of having a pillow to land on.
Mm-hmm.
But now being in Bulgaria, what's the worst that can happen to you? Nothing. Everybody owns apartments here.
That's actually a great
question. Grandparents, your grand-grandparents, you can make living for whatever, especially if you have some talent. You're never going to be hungry or homeless.
Speaking of failure, that's actually also a great question, because I don't believe that we talk enough about our failures and how important mindset in this kind of situations could be, because these are usually also the situations where we learn the most. Now, when I was doing my research, you know, reading different articles, the interviews that you have given before that, I can read everything about your successes, but tell me about your failures. Maybe the milestones were, I don't know, which had a turning point where you learned the most.
Of course, you learn the most from your greatest failures. I have plenty of such. The biggest failures that I consider myself have experienced are failures of surrounding myself with the wrong people,
mm-hmm.
and not identifying that on time. And this shaped me as a leader in a direction where, for me, the most important thing is being in the room with the right people, surrounding yourself with the wrong people, talents, partners, rivals even,
mm-hmm.
competitors. And this is the most important part for me as a leader.
How do you know if they're the right, maybe from today's perspective, because I guess over time it changes, but
people do change.
People do change as well. How do you know that for the current setting, in the current constellation that you are operating in, that these are the right people?
Time is a huge factor. So in order to know if somebody is the right person or that you've met the right person for whatever, you need some time to get to know him, mm-hmm. to get to know her, even in your personal life.
For me, I would say that not necessarily time, but how many tough situations we have been going through. Because I believe in when it's fair weather, it's actually great, you know, and it's easy to be reliable partners to each other. But when things get tough, the way that you're going to overcome this kind of situation is going to define the relationship. And then you start seeing who are the real people behind it, because I don't know.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. It's part of time. So you know, if you know somebody only for a very short period of time, most likely you have not experienced all sides of his character. Mm-hmm. But once you know him, and I have a notion of a moral compass that encapsulates a lot of things, you know, it's integrity, it's values, it's what you believe in, and the way that you perceive the world and the other people. Mm-hmm. But once you see that somebody has you and somebody have an aligned compass, this is really important for me in a constructive partnership. Yeah. Surrounding with great talent, not always you're aligned, and this is part of shaping you as a leader. So you cannot surround yourself only with like-minded people. Mm-hmm. You want people that challenge you. You want people that argue with you. You want to lose arguments, not only to win arguments. This will be boring and incorrect.
I think the larger the organization gets, the more important are exactly those who are going to challenge you, who are going to even maybe tell you in your face that that's not the right thing that you're doing. I have the feeling that the larger the organization, the more this disparity between the team and the management is becoming. And as soon as you are some kind of like a manager or a leader in the organization, people kind of like stop talking to you sincerely.
I've experienced this rarely in my life.
Yeah.
Only after Upnetix was acquired by Scale Focus.
Yeah.
It was one of the things that I didn't like about that experience. The experience not of acquisition, but the experience of being part of an organization that is vast, especially in Bulgarian terms. Mm-hmm. We grew Scale Focus to approximately 900 people.
And Upnetix when?
Upnetix was 150 when it was acquired.
Okay.
Scale Focus was approximately 250 when acquired Upnetix. Mm-hmm. Combined was 400, 450 people, something like that.
So you doubled it.
And we doubled it for the next 2 years.
Wow.
And one of the things that I personally disliked about the experience was exactly this. You know, being part of a very big organization, you kind of the organization separates itself from you.
Mm-hmm.
I was a C-level manager there.
How are you avoiding this now in Clever Pine, so that I don't know, you are part of the team, you're encourage them to speak to you directly? Maybe sometimes they shouldn't, I don't know. How do you manage that? How do you avoid?
This is in the very constructive of Clever Pine. So there were a lot of don'ts,
mm-hmm.
and will not do's, mm-hmm. when we started. And one of the things that we really set in our roadmap as something that we will not move was the size of the organization.
Mm-hmm.
Clever Pine is kept at 150 people in its growth. So we will never outgrow 150 people.
Okay, that's interesting.
And this, together with the concept of a lifestyle company,
mm-hmm.
shapes Clever Pine for what it is and how it does business. So mm-hmm. I don't know if you're familiar with the notion of a lifestyle company.
No, I am, because years ago I was we were having this call and I was actually curious about your concept and how do you design it. I'm not sure if it's like an established framework or is there a methodology of how do you grow a lifestyle
there is a textbook.
Business. I know of lifestyle businesses. There is probably also a textbook, okay. The question is, of course, how do you apply it? But before we come to that, because you are, you know, throwing things which I want to ask you about, tell me about the acquisition. I mean, okay, so you are entrepreneur not out of necessity. You have your biggest failures sometimes, you know, being with the wrong people in the wrong room maybe, but then all of a sudden you actually exit your company. How many exits did you have so far of businesses? It's just this one?
One and a half. Let's put it one and a half.
I remember that there is actually a second story. So the experience that you have, of course, gained with the integration of Upnetics then in Scale Focus is probably one of the reasons why you decided to set up Clever Pine in a different way. But what did you learn from that success back then?
From the acquisition?
From the acquisition, yes.
To be honest, I learned a lot. Mm-hmm. I learned a lot from the leaders of Scale Focus. Mm-hmm. I learned a lot about myself, of what I really enjoy doing versus not. it was a hell of an experience, to be absolutely honest.
Maybe also a bonding experience for you and the partners, right? And the co-founders of that you're now still working on.
We can say that, but it was, we, all of my partners and I, we know each other before Scale Focus, mm-hmm. With some of them before, with most of them before Upnetics. So yeah. We started working back.
Even before Upnetics, oh
yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, we started working together back in 2011 in a Bulgarian-Austrian company.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, so we know each other for quite some time. It's wow. almost 15 years now wow. working together. So I didn't learn that much about my partners, current partners in Scale Focus, but I learned a lot about business, scaling an organization, mm-hmm. and going international in the true means. There were a lot of lessons learned, especially in organizational behavior and setup that we experienced there.
Mm-hmm. Viktor Bilansky was here on the podcast. He was also sharing about his learnings as a leader. I'm sure that he would be glad to hear what you just said. Now, another success that I believe is unparalleled, at least what we have experienced here in Eastern Europe. And I do believe that we underestimate ourselves a bit too much. And you prove that that's not necessary, that we can be actually proud and confident of what we can do. And this success is your joint venture with a company like Lufthansa Technik. Now, Lufthansa Technik is, I don't know, that's probably a whole country if you look at the employee numbers worldwide. I'm not even sure. I don't know how many they are.
They're not that much in terms of people. It's an interesting history of LHT. So LHT mm-hmm. predates Lufthansa.
Okay.
So it was...
Really?
It was...
Okay.
Founded or something like that. So it in 1951... Wow. After the Second World War, the concept of servicing military planes, of course.
Yes.
And then civil planes
mm-hmm.
that were at that point American,
mm-hmm.
of course, and the aviation that came from the North America to Europe and the division of the mm-hmm. West and East Germany. So they started operating back then. afterwards they became part of this aviation company, that's Lufthansa.
Yeah.
Which by itself could be a country, because Deutsche Lufthansa are over 250,000 people.
Yeah, that's...
And Lufthansa Technik are part of this group that were spinned off as a separate company relatively soon in 1995, but they're 100% owned by Lufthansa.
Mm-hmm.
So they're just an entity within
Lufthansa. Okay.
They're
interesting.
There are 21,000 people working there.
Mm-hmm.
But having a joint venture with Lufthansa Technik is by itself having a joint venture with Lufthansa. And this is the country that you mentioned, 200,000 people. It was quite a journey establishing the venture itself. And it was even a longer journey getting to the joint venture.
Were they a customer of yours in the beginning? So Clever Pine started in 2021, in the pandemic year. Okay. And they were a customer of yours already early on, right? Or no?
No.
Okay.
No. So Clever Pine started working with LHT and Deutsche Lufthansa. They are publicly owned companies.
Mm-hmm.
With a major state-owned part.
Mm-hmm.
So most of the tenders that they have, they are public.
Yes.
So we identified a tender in mid-2021 that we applied for.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And we eventually won the bid.
Really?
Yes.
With a company that has been just established a couple of months ago.
They didn't know that. That's part of why we were allowed in this bid. They found it really, really late. I mean, really, really late. When we already have won the bid and we started the contracting.
Amazing.
And their procurement department was really frustrated about it.
Okay.
But anyhow.
Mm-hmm.
We started with a very small project. This was maybe one of the reasons why they either way allowed it, even though it was so freshly founded. It was a very small project in their size, even in our size, that we delivered on time and on budget,
mm-hmm.
which was
rare.
Which is something rare in...
Which never happens, to be honest, right?
in the IT world in general, especially in their IT world.
Mm-hmm.
And this opened the door for second project, third project. And
did you have to go through the public tender procedure again?
Most of the times, yes. Okay. Sometimes, no.
Okay.
But
tough. Okay.
It is always tough.
Yeah.
But at some point, what LHT identified in Clever Pine is that we do things differently. Else, this is something that's in the core of Clever Pine. Having 15 years of experience in the IT services world,
mm-hmm.
establishing Clever Pine, the idea was that in Clever Pine we will not do what everybody else does. And what everybody else does is setting up body shops, staff augmentation, body leasing companies. So they basically sell people CVs and profile to whoever need that talent.
Yes.
In Clever Pine, this is a no-go for us.
What do you sell them? Do you...
Products.
Okay. So the risk of... guarantees are that the product or the software is going to work is with you, right?
That is correct. Well, that's only a small part of it. So the biggest part of it is the notion of who runs the project,
mm-hmm.
and who commits to the project. Does the client commit or do we commit? Because when you hire people,
mm-hmm.
from a company, whatever company, that's a body shop, standard IT services company, you are running the project as a company and you hire talent. You may like or dislike the talent, but at the end of the day, if the project is done for 2 years or 10 years or 15 years of successful or not successful, is a function of your company.
Yes.
Not of the vendor.
Yes.
And with what we wanted to do with Cleverpine is to set autonomous product teams that are complete in all the roles that you need to build a software product.
Mm-hmm.
And we do not sell people or man hours. We sell the commitment that with a team of this size or whatever size that we construct, we will deliver this in a time frame for a fixed budget. And one of the important things in doing this is to separate the client from the project, which is really mind-boggling at first. So it's their project. How are they separated but from their project? But this is absolutely necessity if you want to operate with your velocity and not with the velocity of the client. And as always, your clients are mostly bigger companies than you, that are slower than you. Mm-hmm. And if you operate with their velocity, they will for sure end up with a product that is delivered with their own limitations.
Sure, of course.
So it has a lot of explanation. It can go for hours, but at the end, the most important thing about LHT was that we did it differently and we kind of cut themselves from their project, their projects. We gather the business intelligence, the information, the requirements gathering phase, and then we worked with our velocity and show them this is done in 2 weeks, this after 2 weeks, this after 4 weeks, 8, 9, 10 weeks. And we slowly gain their trust that we know what we do.
Mm-hmm.
And this grew from one product to two products, three product teams, four product teams working for LHT. At some point, we became so essential. Cleverpine became so essential for the digitalization process of LHT that they couldn't afford to lose Cleverpine.
Shit.
And hence, we started forming what is now VTech as a joint venture vehicle for LHT to have an internalized capabilities to continue what Cleverpine started.
Okay, we'll have a couple of questions here, but maybe let's start with the VTech. So it's a joint venture where you and LHT are participating. And what kind of projects are you running in the organization? How much can you tell? I guess that some of them are strictly confidential. I don't know.
There might be confidential projects that I'm not aware of. But
okay.
Basically, it's really important to understand what's LHT, and this is what I now learn and evolve myself as a leader and as a person from LHT. What LHT does. LHT, we all know, they service and maintain aircrafts. And they do not want to change that. Because, and this is very rare in today's world, everybody today are trying to reinvent themselves, to be a digital company, to be a digital frontier, a platform for whatever. They don't want that. Mm-hmm. They identify themselves as with their core business, and they do believe, and I'm sure that they're correct, that in 100 years they'll do the same. They will service different airplanes and different engines and different parts of the airplane, but they'll service airplanes.
Look, from what I see, you have to invest a lot in your expertise to be able to do that at all. I mean, the engineering excellence that you need to service airplanes is a totally different level than what we call engineers in an IT company. I'm sorry.
I
was very impressed because I was also visiting some of the hangars here that they have in Sofia. It's mind-blowing.
That is true.
Mm-hmm.
And LHT, this is part of the answer of your question. LHT is the biggest MRO, a maintenance and repair operator in the world.
Yeah.
So being the biggest, one thing that you cannot do is buy ready-made software.
Mm-hmm.
And being one of the oldest companies, maybe the oldest company in the field, they, through the years, they've went through a normal digitalization process. Like they had some things on paper, those grew in Excel tables, mm-hmm. then Visual Basic with Excel, then some mm-hmm. small products, naturally for the past 30 years.
Yeah.
And now during the pandemic, 2020, when everything stopped, for them was a milestone in time where they realized that they will not change what they do, but they have to modernize the way they do it.
Mm-hmm.
And they established a digitalization program that runs with a time frame that for us in Bulgaria is hard to grasp. You know, first leg is 15 years, next leg is 30 years. But this is part of their business.
Our time frame is 9 months, you know, talking about rotation and so on and so forth.
Yes, but that's something of their business. They know that now, if today there is a new airplane coming on the market, it will be produced for the next 20 to 40 years, if it's successful. And then after the last one is produced, it will be in service the next 40 years.
Oh, wow.
So
okay.
Their time frame of 40, 50, 60, 60 years, this is a normal operating time frame for their business. The planes that we currently use, or at least the Boeing Jumbo Jets 747, those are almost 60 years old.
Don't tell me that.
No, they could be produced last year, but...
Yes.
But they're old as when they were announced on the market. Mm-hmm. And they still maintain those everywhere around the world.
Okay, but then what is an IT software development, and it's not actually IT, it's a software development company doing for them?
They have
what is
over 150 systems of some sort. Some are Excel-based, some are SAP-based, some are homebrewed within some room in LHT. Somebody mm-hmm. decided to do something for his own needs, let's put it that way.
Speaking of silos, yeah.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
But silos are important in part mm-hmm. of when we talk about LHT because they are siloed for a reason. Mm. And this will continue in their business plan and operation mode. But those systems we now start to modernize, to put in a common infrastructure, but not in a common platform. So each system will be separate. Some system may be part of, a construct of 2-3 existing systems, but some will be not, just modernizing. But at the end, what they will receive in 10 years from now is having all of their systems in a common infrastructure that they can talk to each other, that they're produced and developed in a modern and common way.
Mm-hmm.
And the next leg of their digitalization will be how to optimize, innovate, and integrate, if needed, part of those.
Mm-hmm.
But first leg is siloed again.
Okay, which means that in order to develop this kind of systems and, I don't know, build them agile enough so that they're future-proof, so that you know, eventually you can then start building the integration between them whenever it makes sense, you need not only the engineering expertise, but you also need to understand the business logic behind it, which is actually very specific because I'm not even sure that I know other aviation
MRO operators.
I don't know. Maybe there are others.
But
they are definitely the biggest. So It's not something that you can read in an article of how do you build a system like that. Then you start learning and applying it. So for you, you need to start learning about the industry yourself, right?
Yes, and Clever Pine had company. Absolutely Clever Pine had to start learning. Now VTech is on the road of.
Is there a Lufthansa Technik bootcamp where you can jump in? I guess you're kind of like becoming part of the team now.
Yes, yeah. Absolutely. VTech is part of LHT, and Clever Pine is well embedded within LHT in their different segments, so what you call silos.
Yeah.
Silos. So you have to understand it. But this is part of the way that Clever Pine operates for all our clients.
Yeah.
So we have, in order to commit and develop a product for somebody, and they touch the product development phase from the client, you kind of have to be absolutely sure what you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
So we have a vast business analysis and requirement gathering teams, and the team composition of each product team consists with engineering managers, business requirement engineer, and quality engineer that together understand what has to be done. They map it out, and afterwards they work with the developers to do it versus the client, in that case being LHT, working with the developers to explain what is to be done. So the notion that we know what the client needs is within the team from day one of the development process. So there are months, sometimes few months, where we gather information, our engineering managers, our requirement engineers, and our quality engineers understand what is to be done and how it works, how it should work, and what should be the end result.
Yeah.
But afterwards, when we start the development process, all this knowledge is within the team and works with the velocity of the team, not with the velocity of that.
And that's a principle that you apply not just in the VTech team and project, but in general when it comes to Clever Pine. So you build these cross-functional teams that over time they start developing their own expertise, and they are aware of what the customer needs and what can be done within the requirements.
Absolutely, yes. That's valid.
It's documented somewhere. Okay.
That is valid for every client of Clever Pine.
Wow. Okay. You mentioned before that, and I'm here pretty sure that most of the software companies that are kind of like watching us are envying you, because they think, yeah, we also don't want to do only time and material. We don't want to sell bodies. We want to jump into exactly those projects where we have also more control and more responsibility of what is going to happen. In the sense, I wonder, what are the secrets? I'm thinking that you must have huge expertise when it comes to project management and product development. How do you develop that in a market where these people are not enough, for instance? That's what I hear everywhere.
You absolutely need a very good products and project managers.
Yeah.
You self grow them, basically. That's how it should be done. That's how I believe it should be done.
Where do you grow them? Where are they? Where is
it? Over there behind the bar. Behind the
product
bar.
Manager incubator.
But the long answer, I'll get you back to a lifestyle company.
Okay.
So a lot of companies here, they envy, as you said, or they want to do this because this is exciting.
Maybe they admire you, right? That's the wrong word. I mean,
but this is exciting.
Yeah.
This brings a lot of value add for the client, but it brings a lot of enjoyment for the people that are doing it. And they feel part of something that they can steer and that they contribute not only by being sold to the client. And one of the things that is basically required in order to step this way is to be a lifestyle company. So being a lifestyle company, the textbook definition we'll put aside, but most important thing about being a lifestyle company is that you do not care about what the market wants or your numbers, revenue, growth, new client acquisition or whatever. You only should care about doing what you believe in. And this
I
is the
know
only
many businesses that went south this way, but I think, you know, the inputs from the market are very important, because then you start developing something that the market doesn't want. So I guess in some ways you do stuff.
It is a risk
the
endeavor.
Way that you believe, but then how do you provide value to your customers? If you don't provide value to your customers, who is going to buy it?
It is a risk endeavor, but who said you don't provide? Clever Pine, with the sole idea, the conception is to provide more value to the customers.
It is a function of both. What, you know, the market is actually telling you, that's the market niche, that's where we need you. And then you still somehow stick to the beliefs and the value systems that you have developed as an organization. I think it cannot go one without the other.
You might be right.
Yeah.
Let me put it from my perspective.
Okay.
When we started, the market had zero signals that it needs service like ours.
Mm-hmm.
It was really hard to start. When you start speaking to clients, they're, okay, product teams, give me 2 developers. And you're like, no, we're product teams. Okay, 3 developers. So
it's an upsell.
It's an upsell. And then it goes to 5 developers and you still have to cancel this and reject this. So it's, and in a construct where this is not a lifestyle company, this is an exit-based company, you know that you have to grow fast in 3-5 years.
True.
So you'll never be able to do this.
Never.
You'll never be able to stay laser focused on what you believe in. Markets, I do not believe that markets, there are market signals, there's upside, downsides, black swan events. There are a lot of things that you have to analyze.
Especially in the past couple of years.
Yes.
By the way.
But this does not mean that the market wanted the iPhone back in 2011.
Mm-hmm.
Or the car back in, I don't know.
No, Ford. We wanted BlackBerries back then.
We wanted BlackBerries
with
and they wanted faster carriages.
Yeah.
Back in the day, nobody wanted a car. So I'm not putting Clever Pine within those visionaries, but it is something that we believed that is part of the future of the IT services sector. It will not change the whole sector.
Mm-hmm.
Body leasing, staff augmentation will always be there, and maybe will always be the vast majority of the sector, 80, 60, 90%, I don't know. But what we believed in, that there is a niche for certain companies that will believe in this greater value add model.
Mm-hmm.
Not all companies will do it for various reasons. A lot of companies are afraid of externalizing those. They want to run it internally with external talent, but you know, we run it internally. At the end, some are successful, some are not. Most of the big ones, successful or not, are very slow. So it's wanting to do something like this requires that you stop looking at the numbers, stop allowing yourself to be operated by your metrics, and you're staying laser focused on what you want.
Well, maybe. Because numbers are just a function of different things that we want to have measured. And maybe we need to start looking at different numbers. As a software development company who is doing the things in a different way to, provide a sort of a methodology or a sort of an orientation. Okay, we won't be looking at the classic business growth numbers and KPIs, we're actually also looking at certain other things like, attrition rate or...
Everybody's looking at their attrition rate.
I don't know, like to measure the health of the company. But wait,
the happiness. Okay,
tell me about the happiness.
We're focused on the happiness.
How do you measure that? How do you how fast the Japanese whiskey is going out in your office or
one way is the bar behind me. But the other way is the commitment from the team members. It's because commitment is closely aligned with gratification and reward and how you feel about yourself. That's why people generally have tough time committing to hard goals like going to the gym every day, not overeating or whatever. And if you enjoy what you do, you kind of don't have problem with the commitment.
So a lifestyle company is not a company that goes easy with a nice lifestyle necessarily. Do I understand it right? Because sometimes you do have to commit. I mean, you do have to push until the deadline that you have, taken responsibility for in front of the customer. Yeah,
I would say that you're mainly right.
Yeah.
With few nuances.
Okay.
So yes, lifestyle company does not mean that it's all play and enjoyment.
Mm-hmm.
But it means that you have to feel enjoyment and satisfaction from your work. We are very keen on office days and office hours and commitment from the people. And this by itself, it's a filter for who wants to stay in the company and who gets his gratification and reward.
That's another interesting aspect. So you launch a company amidst the pandemic and you decide that it's not going to be like everyone else who is trying to adapt to work from anywhere, remote culture and so on and so forth. But you decide that you're going to establish an office first kind of culture, like we prefer to work in the office. How do you have some rules?
Back in the pandemic, it was 3 days in the office, 2 days not in the office.
I don't want to ask about the rules today, I guess.
It's 100%.
It's 100%.
It's 100%.
How do you manage to get the people? I mean, from what we have heard, especially now the Gen Zs, you know, they want to be flexible in any sense of the world, which is also related to flexibility when it comes to working from anywhere. How do you manage to bring the people back in the office? Is it a question of selection? Then I feel that some companies and some CEOs will be very envious of you.
It is a question of selection, for sure.
Okay.
On one hand side. On the other hand side, it is again part of, if you enjoy and you feel satisfied with what you do and you get that gratification of your day-to-day work, and I mean immediate gratification, so you're happy with what you do today, not in general terms.
Yeah. Not when the project is finished.
Yes. Okay. Or when you receive bonus or something like that.
Yeah.
If you're happy, then you will, and you're happy with the team members that you're surrounded with and by, and part of the team that you are, and part of the, even if you want, the culture and the landscape of the office, and if you identify yourself with, I don't know, the bar behind us, then you come every day to the office and this will not bother you. And because you get immediate gratification, it's like whatever you want, eating an ice cream, having sex, it's nothing that you avoid. Yeah.
Okay. Is there a place where I can nap? Yeah, just joking. Okay. I don't want to go into the spicy rubbers in your kitchen.
No. It's not something that you avoid. You like it. You like it because of the immediate gratification of how it makes you feel after eating an ice cream. And
there, my shrink would say that, you know, there is only immediate gratification. Anything else is just, much more relate to, are you able to be a disciplined person? And especially when you are tired or frustrated or whatever, you're always looking for the immediate gratification. That's why you start overeating and then so on and so forth. Okay, interesting. Wait, we started talking about the lifestyle company because I asked you about how do you actually design the teams and how do you make sure that you take over these fancy projects where you have all the, I don't know, most of the control, but also most of the risk. And then you still deliver on time and within the scope of what has been initially arranged. Okay, what's the secret behind that? I think many would actually like to know. So it is, you know, growing the product and the project managers in-house. You obviously have some kind of hidden incubator here in the office. Maybe these are two different topics. So which are the other secrets and how do you grow talent here in the company? So effectively, obviously.
So other secrets? It is a vast list, you know. It starts with culture, it starts with selecting people.
Culture is a topic like this. I'm trying to know exactly.
Selecting the right people, motivating them. But at the end, it is a function of everything. And it's a function of this autonomous way of work. It is a function of them being part of one team, not part of a, if you want, organization, a matrix organization. So it's part of how you structure your organization.
But these teams, they remain stable?
Yes.
For each of the customers? Or do you have like, okay, I'm part here now of this team, and then for another client, I'm part of another? Okay, so they remain stable over time. So it's like mini companies within the organization.
That is correct. So each mini company, as you said, is run by an engineering manager.
Okay.
And the team is relatively or mostly fixed. So there are new team members joining. Some people are leaving. Sometimes you need to switch skill sets. But these are exceptions. So the teams are constant. One team is working for one project, or if they work for multiple projects, this is also an exception. But they work for the same client as for sure, because they gather the knowledge of the industry and the client. And it was basically client's request to work on two projects or operate one project while developing another one. So some kind of maintenance while you develop. But the teams are constant. And it is a tight community. A team is approximately 10 to 12 people, depending on the size of the team. So you're part of a very small cohort, a very small group that is completely aligned in its day-to-day tasks.
Interesting. I like that, because then you still kind of like keep this maybe overused today, but the startup-y vibe. I think this is why, you know, startups have actually this superpower, because they build very cohesive small teams in the beginning, which makes them very fast, very agile, very empowered when it comes to decision making. And you're partially applying this kind of principle or this kind of culture in the project management teams?
Completely. One product team is one startup team.
And what is then the role of the management in this kind of organization? I was also wondering, you know, I asked you at the beginning of our conversation before we started recording, like, what is your title in the company? Who is like the CEO here? And you mentioned then nothing, we don't have this. So what is the role of the other three co-founders that you have in the I don't know, I guess maybe management is structured in a different way, but how do you manage the startups and organize them around the same values and so on and so forth?
So it is a relatively flat structure. So it's the four of us as co-founders, and below us it's only one layer of management. Those are the engineering managers. All four of the co-founders work with the engineering managers on various topics, but we operate as a single body. So it is one single body of engineering managers and co-founders that work together.
And what is your function? What do you provide as guidance or value or,
My personal function?
For instance,
It's, I internally, we call it strategy. So I am behind the strategy and vision of Cleverpine and more or less the operational model of Cleverpine.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
That includes sales and marketing, of course.
Okay.
Because it's part of...
Of course.
...of how we work and where we want to go. Otzi, he works with the engineering managers in terms of technology and technology vision and strategy.
Okay.
Litvi works in terms of delivery and product slash project topics. And lastly, Didu, he works with the engineering managers and the rest of the management, because we have, of course, marketing manager, head of office and administration. He works with them on operational topics.
Yeah, okay. And it's interesting. You mentioned also in the beginning that when it comes to this leadership role, and actually career advancement in general, that it is actually very important for you to work on yourself. So I wonder, in this kind of constellation, which are the steps or the hacks that you have so that you keep yourself in check, so that you grow with the needs maybe of the organization, of, you know, the teams that you're involved in, of the people, maybe also the zeitgeist, I guess, you know, younger generation, they expect a different kind of leader. I don't know.
They do.
How do you work on yourself?
I believe that the only way of working on yourself is to be self-reflecting a lot and to allow others' opinion and the impact of others on you. So I, in order to grow myself and to start working with younger generation, I first of all spend time with them. Second of all, I'm open-minded and perceptive to their input. Because their input, some of them are fresh juniors that joined the company. Some are not that young, some are more mature, but all of the people that surround me, they shape me. It's, I don't think that you can shape yourself without bumping into objects or people or something else. It's how do you shape yourself in a vacuum? Not having external input like podcasts, books, other people. You can't, or I don't think that you can.
I do believe that by developing relationships and also by overcoming, you know, challenges in them, I think it's much easier to shape yourself. I do believe in the power of content that, you know, it kind of like can be an impulse for you to think about certain things, to be a bit more observant on what is happening in your everyday life. But I personally was shaped most through the relationships that I have developed in my life. And they could be private, but they could be also at work. I mean, I all call them relationships in the end. And it's, I love crisis and I love challenging situations in these relationships, because now that I'm 36, when I look back, I'm most grateful for the difficult times that I had. Otherwise, I wouldn't be the person that I am today.
Absolutely.
That's how I see it, yeah.
I share it completely. It's constantly working with people, surrounding yourself with the right people, people that are different than you, that challenge you, that have different perspective, and staying, of course, open-minded, because this is something that I strongly emphasize on myself, is not to become a grumpy mid-aged guy that knows everything. So even the stupidest idea that I hear, I really, really try to be open-minded and to understand why and where it comes from. And am I missing something?
Interesting. Well, you mentioned that one of the things that is by design defined in this way and Clever Pine is that you're never going to exceed 150 people. Well, what is your wildest dream for Clever Pine then? I mean, you're not aiming at an exit. You're not aiming at growth. What are you aiming at? How would you know, I don't know, like in 10 years that, yes, we made it. And you're going to, I don't know, pour yourself a glass of
whatever. Yeah.
What are you? What is your favorite drink?
I love peated whiskeys. So, Islay, Isla. It's an island in Scotland. So, Art Deco, for example, it's Brandes.
Okay. So you're going to pour yourself one, and you're going to say yes. That's.
It's a really nice question. Mm-hmm. I get what it boggles you and turns you in a circle. It's the lifestyle company.
Yes, of course. I want to learn a bit more.
So being limited of sheer size and doing what you believe in, where is the end goal? So, and we had this question in ourselves when we started, but
I'm sure, yeah.
You know, as I said, the whole idea of Clever Pine was to provide greater value add to our customers. Question is how you measure value add. But to answer in a short and very business, a straight business forward way, if we today work with companies like LHT, we aim in 5 years to work with companies that are in Fortune 50. In 50 years, every company in Fortune 5 should be a company that works with Clever Pine. So this will be a measure of success.
But now I see your trick, you know, with this joint venture, you're basically, you know, establishing a new entity. So you're going to start spinning off, you know, all these little joint ventures and this little team. So, you know, you would still remain 150. Sorry, but your impact at the end will be much higher. Just joking.
Yeah.
Okay.
That could be true, but, you know, we get back to being a lifestyle company. The question of what is next after Clever Pine, not for Clever Pine, does not exist.
Mm-hmm.
If you love doing something every day and it fulfills your needs, monetary or whatever needs, why should you aim for something after Clever?
Because people are designed like this.
But the people are designed like this because they pursue something that they do not do at the moment. If you do what you like and what you love at the moment, why? Why would you seek after that? If, I don't know, whatever is your desire, you know, having a beach villa in Malibu or Bahamas or whatever, do you ask yourself, and what's next? Where is my next villa going?
The moment you buy your villa in Malibu, you're definitely going to start thinking about the next one, which is going to be a villa in, I don't know, Beverly Hills, probably.
Probably. And and what you can see from the guys that have afforded multiple villas and every villa, eventually they end up with one.
Look, it is already a widespread knowledge that we cannot, you know, complete our internal vacuums with external stuff. And, you know, Buddhists have been teaching that for, I don't know how many thousand years. And at the same time, that's human nature. We are reading about it. We say, yeah, that's true. That's very wise. And then we still keep on pursuing stuff that we believe are, as soon as we achieve them, are going to make us happy. That we are currently not happy because we're missing something, because that's the goal. And then we, I don't know, strive for it. So I believe that what you're doing here is a very interesting social and maybe also a psychological experiment, yeah? Which, if you're going to, I don't know, find the secrets of establishing a culture that makes people happy because they enjoy their everyday life, their everyday lifestyle, and work becomes not work, but it's actually your life. And this is why I guess it's called a lifestyle company. Then why would you touch a running system? Yeah, why would you change anything? It's true, could be.
You continuously evolve with you as a person, you as a company, but yeah.
But I have another question, because I do believe that, you know, a couple of people are playing with the idea of maybe starting their own project. So what would you do if a team that is working on a certain solution actually come up with a startup idea? And then it actually makes sense because you are close to the market. I mean, you're working with the customer. Then it makes sense to actually spin it out and, I don't know, support them and grow a startup that, I don't know, grows on a totally different logic.
Yep. Okay. This is exactly what we'll do. We have a venture arm, Clever Pine Ventures. We have invested in several companies already.
Amazing.
We have spin out teams. So, yeah, it is absolutely normal.
So you're not denying the model?
No, not at all.
Yeah. Okay.
Not at all. You know, it's this pursuit of what you want to do and identifying a new business, a niche or model, or of course we have multiple ventures at that point.
That's very interesting. I think in the sense, in a couple of years, or maybe even like in 20 years, you could be also this organization that has shaped the lives of many people. And I think this is sometimes even more rewarding, especially when you work with young, you know, professionals. For some of them, it could be like the first, you could be the first employer, or maybe someone who has actually is going to shape their work hygiene, their values on the workplace, and so on and so forth. And because you're trying to establish a different culture, I do believe that some of the people would proudly say in their CVs, yeah, and we were part of Clever Pine, you know, because that means something. Just how nowadays being a former Telerik employee means something for most people, you know?
That is absolutely true for Telerik, and we already started saying for Clever Pine, we work with a lot of young people.
Yeah.
We hire a lot of fresh talent, I mean, people in their very early 20s. And on one hand, this is an obligation exactly on the work hygiene. That's why it's 5 days in the office. That's why it's strict office hours, because for them, this is new. They cannot assume it. They cannot come with this knowledge from somewhere. But on the other hand side, we have multiple people already that left the company, went somewhere, and either they did themselves a mini Clever Pine communities, and they join us in the bar in this area. We spend time together years after, and we already started to experience some of this gratification that you're talking about. Because I'm really proud that we work with young people, and I'm really proud that people identify themselves with Clever Pine. Some leave. We have people that left the company and returned on the next Monday. We have people that left the company and returned in 1 year. And they kind of always remember Clever Pine with something nice and how it shaped them. And I believe it's every business, regardless if it's lifestyle company or not, should have this moral obligation to bring that back to the society. You know, you make money out of the society. And you benefit the society, whatever, you know, education, educational system, healthcare system, and you have to bring back that.
Yeah, I think it is coming exactly with entrepreneurs, this kind of like give back culture. I think because of our past and the shift in this economical systems that we had, the entrepreneurial community was pretty much destroyed in our history. But now, especially with the boom of digital IT, software development, and so on and so forth in our part of the world, we start seeing again this entrepreneurial generation that is not only benefiting from, as you mentioned, from society, from an economical perspective, but is much more ready to give back to society. And it's very interesting how it's always the entrepreneurs who actually start, they make the biggest donation sometimes. They make actually also the foundation of the whole educational ecosystem and so on.
Sofia University.
Exactly. It is another great story, which is actually coming from the entrepreneurial community.
Yeah. I do believe it's a very natural and logical step for every entrepreneur and successful leader to want to give back.
It is connected also to something which is how do you actually solve certain problems? And I think entrepreneurs are in the first place problem solvers. And then on the second, they want to make money and they want to have impact. First is like, okay, I see a problem, I need to change it. Then you are so impatient about solving it and changing it that you just start working on it.
Yeah. That is the definition of a leader.
Yeah.
And an entrepreneur. You're continuously trying to do something, change something for the better. And it's a never-ending story.
It is a never-ending story. But as long as we heard and we learned that from, as long as you have gratification, you receive a gratification from this on a daily level, you're good and you're qualified to work for Clever. Just joking.
But it's not joking. It's absolutely true. You know, everybody has bad days, but if you do not enjoy working for Clever Pine and what you do here, you are a misfit here. Mm-hmm. Most of our people and team members, they're misfits elsewhere.
Yeah.
And they're constantly frustrated by the slowness or the red tape or whatever in other organizations. But if you don't like what we do here and you don't love working in Clever Pine or VTech, and that's, you're a misfit. You know, it's not the place for you. You're not for Clever Pine. Clever Pine is not for you.
We keep on forgetting that it goes both ways. You know, this culture fit is not only about, you know, an employee fitting to organization, but also is the organization actually fitting to my needs? And I think this is important. I've enjoyed talking to you. I don't know about working with you, for you. maybe I need to look a bit more in depth. But from what I hear so far, I have to say that, I have to honestly say congratulations, because I'm learning also the hard way of how to build an organization, you know, how to be a leader. And in certain things, I haven't found an answer. Of course, in many ways, I do want people who are joining organizations to be happy, but that's such a difficult thing to achieve. And it changes over time, you know, for a while they're happy, then they're not happy, and then you think, what did I do wrong? And so on and so forth. So I would love to exchange also a bit more on that, of how do you design and how do you achieve that? Because obviously it works, at least for more than 100 people, it works for now.
Tough question.
It's, yeah.
I don't think that I have a short or whatever straightforward answer, but as a lot of other things in being a leader and entrepreneur, it's a matter of iterations.
Mm-hmm.
You continuously iterate so that you feel happy and you feel aligned with what you want to do.
Mm-hmm.
And it is, again, it is a relentless pursuit of this, because your team members, your partners, and your clients and everybody else there, in subconsciously, not intentionally, trying to steer you off this. And it is, you have to keep the steering wheel very hard, you know, the rabbit, and steer it yourself rather than allow it to go wherever the gravity and the market opportunity or the people understanding of what is at that moment their desire.
Or hype,
mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Hype is a big part of it, especially for the young generation.
Yeah.
And social pressure, you know, they literally, I have three kids, they live in social media and in this social pressure. And they want to comply. It's everybody want to comply. You know, people in general, that we are beings that are herd beings. We've always wanted to be part of a herd. It's where we feel safe. And there are multiple experiments on having 10 people that say that this water is green, and that the 11 people, you know, that it's all green. They say, hey, it's green, of course, because you kind of want to blend in.
Exactly.
And not be the misfit.
I think that's our strongest instinct, actually, you know, and quite often we are ready to do certain compromises with our own values, with our own self, just to be part of a group, just to have the feeling that we belong to a group. And that's why I think our work also as organization builders is actually so important, because it is shaping people, it's shaping people's life. Rado, thank you for inviting us here. Thank you for letting us learn a bit more about the secrets and the secret spices of your kitchen, because we're here actually, you know, in this huge social space where you have the kitchen and where you obviously bring the people together. And I was looking at the foosball tables and so on and so forth, and the PlayStation corner, and these are, and the bar, of course. And these things are, I believe, great. But I think you found another essential part of what keeps people working for an employer. I think at some point we started believing that it's all about these things which you are here, but it's not. And you stay the course, you keep your values so that you actually provide them with fun work. Not a work that would require of them to distract themselves here in order to feel okay while they're coding or engineering a solution. I think that's the concept which probably is more successful in the long run. At least we will see. It is a solution. I mean, it is. Which company is that for you that you have founded?
Fourth.
It's the fourth time. We will be looking closely at the social and psychological experiment that you're doing here. Please invite us also next time again when you have a big story.
Thank you for being here, and you're always welcome.
Thank you.
And if you're just as passionate about innovation as we are, hit subscribe for the Recursive Podcast on YouTube or your favorite podcast platform. We're everywhere.